Sheffield Live. Made in Sheffield, made by you.
If you like rock in all its forms, you will love Glory Days. You can listen to us locally on 93.2 FM and on the telly, and anywhere in the world on sheffieldlive.org. What do you think, Dawn? You know what? I think he likes it. That's Glory Days, every Monday 1 till 3 here on Sheffield Live. Bosh, bosh. Oops, I've had an accident.
Hello, I'm Harry Wilburn. I present Steel & Wire every Wednesday, 10 a.m. Americana, Bluegrass, American Roots, and more. Lots more. Lots of guests, lots of local music and musicians. That's Steel & Wire, Wednesday, 10 a.m.
You're listening to fabulous Harry Wilburn on Steel & Wire.
It's time to open the music box. Join me, Steve Roden, every Thursday morning between 10 and 12 for music from the 40s to the 90s from my own music collection. Songs I've grown up with, ones I am sure you will enjoy hearing again. Hope to see you then.
If you love new music and you want to discover the best new artists out there, then tune into The Backroom with me, Paddy. I'll be playing the best of new indie, electro, EDM and punk and showcasing new Sheffield talent. Also music news, local and national gig guide and new album releases. So tune into The Backroom every Thursday night between 6 and 7 p.m. here on Sheffield Live, 93.2 FM.
This is Sheffield Live.
N-E-X-T.
Good morning, welcome to the Life Science Radio Show here on Sheffield Live 93.2 FM on digital if you're in South Yorkshire or sheffieldlive.org. You can listen online there. You can also download the podcast later and listen at your leisure. If you're listening on Catch Up, it is the early May bank holiday Saturday. It's the 2nd of May. It's a very sunny Sheffield. And of course, it's a snooker final as well. All exciting stuff, eh? Got Julian Pauly live as usual, of course. We'll be speaking to our PG later in this hour. He's picked a cracking track for today, but I'm not going to give it away. It's one of my, in fact, it's probably one of my favourite tracks of all time, but there you go. Later in this hour, also, we've got our guest speaker for this week, and indeed every first Saturday of the month. It's Phil Muffett from the Mexburton Swinton Astronomical Society. He'll be talking about Eye on the Sky, club news, and loads more besides, including adventures with his telescope. All good stuff. So in the science news this week, Paul, starting us off.
Yes, a new global conference on transitioning away from fossil fuels is taking place in Colombia this week, aimed at revitalising international efforts to reduce emissions from oil, gas and coal. More than 50 countries as well as sub-national governments are taking part through major emitters such as the US, China and India are not part of the talks.
Oh dear, what a surprise there. Yeah. And this is an interesting one. Chris told me about this a while back. We are a nation of bird lovers. Many of us that have feeders and tables in our gardens support our feathered friends. However, these feeding spots are all too often points where diseases are spread, and some species, notably green finches, are suffering as a result. The Royal Society for the Protection of Birds, or RSPB for short, has recently issued new guidance to stop the transmission of pathogens with a strap line, feed seasonally, feed safely. From May to October, the RSPB advises against putting out seeds or peanuts to encourage birds to seek food elsewhere. In the winter months, however, when there is a lower risk of disease spreading, you can offer up a full range of bird foods. The RSPB also suggests moving feeders around and washing them once a week. Same goes if you put water out for birds like we do. Make sure that water is cleaned all the time.
Ours have a bubble bath as well.
Well,
don't.
No, they don't really, but they do have it. They've got their own private Lido. It's true.
Right. Meanwhile, Natural England has warned that red squirrels will become extinct in mainland England by the middle of the century unless millions of grey squirrels are culled. A do-nothing scenario would see them disappear within 25 years as grey squirrels outcompete red squirrels for food and spread a deadly pox.
Elsewhere in the news, a project to restore more than 1,000 hectares of peatland near Loch Ness has started work with the aim of improving biodiversity, water retention and carbon storage. A partnership of charities and private landowners coordinated by Rewilding Afric Highlands will take part in the scheme.
And finally, the number of years people in the UK spend in good health is falling, according to a new report. Over the past decade, healthy life expectancy, HLE, has dropped by around 2 years to just under 61 years for both men and women. The UK is one of only five of the richest 21 countries to see the HLE decline, and its fall was the second steepest. The L Foundation, which produced the analysis, said there was a significant economic cost to this trend because of the significant impact on the ability of people to work. And this aligns with other figures showing high numbers of people below retirement age out of work because of ill health. The analysis, which was based on data from the Office for National Statistics between 2022 and 2024 and 2012 and 2014, also found those in the wealthiest 10% areas could expect to have around 20 more years of good health than those in the poorest.
And that report's an interesting one because it links the causes of all that are often to do with obesity, poor diet, and things like that, all good stuff. Now, before we speak to RPG, I'm going to talk about bats. Yes, very interesting. I saw this article in the press and thought it's a great one. So how to create your own bat garden. Add water. It doesn't need to be a grand water feature, as a small still pool will do. Even a jar lid with water on a windowsill will attract insects. Light carefully. It's important to use downlights, as uplighting interrupts the life cycle of insects. Use a timer to keep it dark when you go to bed. Plant for nighttime appeal. Think insect banquet with flowers of different heights, colours and scent. These include herbs such as marjoram and borage, daisies and cosmos, umbellifiers such as fennel and false bishop's weed, and flowers with long pollen tubes such as honeysuckle and purple top or verbena. Tall, pale and night-scented options include evening primrose, hemp, agrimony and night-scented stock. Importantly, offer a roost. Bats love nooks and crannies, but you can provide hotel accommodation in the form of bat boxes. You can also buy a bat detector. These devices make bat calls audible for us. They come in all levels of complexity, but most people start off with a relatively basic one called a heterodyne one. And know your bats. The most common of the UK's 19 species of bats are brown long-eared. They come out after dark and usually fly very close to trees, slow and hovering. Pipistrelles, there's three species of which, common soprano and the more rare Nathesis, most likely to be in your garden, emerge at sunset and have an erratic flight pattern. We've actually had over the years a maternity colony of roosting pipistrelles in our gable end, and they're absolutely unbelievable, and they are protected and they won't do any damage, so just let them do the business. And the other type of bat you can see, so that was brown long-eared, pipistrelles, which are probably the most common, and then noctule. Emerge early, just as it starts to get dark, about the size of a starling, with long, narrow wings. So that's all about bats. Keep your eye out.
Sound.
Very interesting track there called Nocturnal Creatures by Moorish Idols. And actually, that was one of RPG's choices for Glorious Rock Show back in 2023.
Wow.
Played that because we're talking about bats, which, of course, are nocturnal creatures. How do we do it? I don't know. You're, of course, listening to Life Science Radio Show here on Sheffield Live 93.2 FM. We should have RPG on the line. Good morning, PG.
Good morning.
On this rather morning. Sunny bank holiday Saturday.
It's gorgeous, isn't it?
It's not bad at all. So what's caught your eye in the science news this week, then?
Well, I've got a story, but not if you've got ophidiophobia.
Oh, my word.
Which is an extreme fear of snakes.
Oh.
Bit of news from India, where they found the remains of a giant snake fossil. It's called Vasuki indicus, and it was a snake which was getting up to about 50 feet long. They think it was, I think the other large snake is called Titanoboa. It's 47 million years old. I think there's some vertebrae of the snake that they found. And because they've got a reasonable selection of those, they've estimated that it could have been anything from 11 to 15 metres long. they also say it was a bit like a boa constrictor. It was an ambush predator. It's a vain weight. But if you've got a fear of snakes, you don't want to turn a corner and come face to face with that one, do you? But also on the large size scale of things, some research from Japan, where they've looked at fossils from up to 100 million years ago, and the fossilized beaks of Pacific octopuses, or octopi, I can't remember if it's either or both. Again, this was something that was 15 metres long, they say, and they had a massively powerful jaw and tentacles. I think the current octopus is something like 16, 17 feet, but this is something along the lines of that, but in metres. 100 million years ago, in the oceans, it had a very smart brain, so it was probably quite a formidable predator of its day. So two big things that were found in science in the last few weeks, and that sort of notification was very good. One of the big things is there's a massive legal case which is going to court over the pollution in the River Wye, Lugh and Usk, so all in Wales, and it's going to court to take out a case against Avara Foods, who are massive producers of chicken, and Welsh Water, who should be looking after the water systems. And they say that the river quality of water has diminished significantly due to chicken manure use on local farms and spills that weren't purposely made. They flag millions of chickens currently being reared along those stretches of water in large barns like structures. So that water system is under pressure. And people trying to do something about it.
Oh, your just signal's just breaking up a bit, Paul, so I might just unplug you and plug you back in. Yeah, I've lost him. Hello, Paul. Are you still there?
Yeah. How you doing?
Oh, I think it might be our connection, Paul. You're very distant.
Move around.
Move, Paul. Are you near a window?
Oh, no.
Okay. We'll try and call you back, Paul. Instead, we'll play your lovely track, a little bit of it, until I get you back.
Okie dokie.
Oh, you're back. Right. Hang on, back. You're back now.
Right. Right.
Yeah, we're not playing your music at all. This is a joy of live radio, Paul, isn't it?
It is.
I'll tell you what, blame your cat.
Righty-o.
Good, you're sounding better than ever as well now.
Right, well, the rest of what I'm going to talk about, I think, is that it's about sense of smell. And realistically, one of the problems I had after, three bouts of COVID was it affected my sense of smell and taste. And sort of looking into that, I said that for a lot of people, if you had that affected, it could be lasting from 2 to 6 weeks before you started to get your sense of smell back. And I thought, well, could it last longer than that? And if you read through NHS research into it, then they're flagging up that it can last 2 to 4 years before you retain.
Oh, wow.
Yep. It can be a permanent affliction. So my poor niece had to suffer when she dropped by one day and I made her a cup of coffee because the milk smelled great to me. Oh. But it wasn't. It was horrible. So looking around to see what was happening, and they say that the lack of sense of smell due to the virus is it attacks the support cells that's in your nasal passages. And I said it can be 4 to 6 weeks in a lot of cases. 1 to 2 years is a bit more extreme, and a permanent loss is even more extreme. So COVID-19 can cause permanent loss. It's called anosmia. And that can cause also distorted smell called parosmia. So it can make what were pleasant smells seem horrible. And it can give you a different take on smells that you're quite used to. So this is flagged up some new research that was posted by Harvard Medical School. And scientists there have discovered how the sense of smell is organized. It's really not been one of the senses that's been really addressed in detail as much as our others sight and things. But what they've done is they've been working with mice, and they've mapped millions of neurons in mice that they discovered in their smell receptors in its nose. And what the findings were is that they're not a random set of receptors. So they're actually arranged in neat overlapping stripes based on the type of receptor. And they're forming a hidden structure which is previously unknown. And that really mirrors how smell information is also mapped in the brain. So there's a direct correlation between this map of the receptors in the nose lining and what our brain does processing that information. So it's revealed this coordinated system from your nose through the neural circuits, and it's often remained less understood than vision, hearing or touch. But then looking on the NHS website, it's a case of, well, can you do anything about the sort of loss of smell? And they say one of the things that you could undertake is smell training. So they offer a guide of using 4 essential oils They use a rose oil, which is floral, lemon, which is a fruity, cloves, which is spicy, and eucalyptus, which they call a resinous smell. And what you do with that is to smell those four times a day, and it can start to retrain your olfactory system to distinguish different smells. So it's kind of what a lot of other things, like in strokes, they take that kind of approach to get you to do a repetitive process to try and retrain muscles, systems, and sort of human faculty functions into what they're used to. And quite often, if people have had dramatic accidents, your body will try and replicate sort of neural pathways that have been damaged with an alternative route to keep that kind of function alive. So it's kind of a bit of a strange one, but generally speaking, I say they start off by saying this is a temporary thing that can probably last up to 2 to 6 weeks, but then can extend out. So it's also part of the post-COVID, the extended COVID reactions, which they push out from 1 to 2 years, which I'm guessing from a lot of COVID reports is probably about as far as they got when they started out on the research path. So it's a reminder, really, that COVID is still around. It can still affect things, and it doesn't always affect you in the ways that you expect. I can sort of vouch for some of the differences. I know I certainly don't smell wine in the way that I used to.
Oh, that's a shame, Paul.
it's not quite there in ways, so it can be quite difficult. And quite often I've got to check with my partner as to whether food is in good condition or not. It's quite difficult sometimes to pick up good or bad food from smell. Obvious indications can help when things turn green or do whatever else. But it's a reminder, and I think that quite often if you haven't got that, it can knock on into things like inflammatory diseases, because the things that you ingest can actually start a reaction to that. So I'm sort of creaking along a bit with arthritis these days, which I'm not quite sure if this has got anything to do with it. But I didn't have an awful experience over the difference of COVID bouts that I had. First one I thought was difficult, but not extreme. Second one was not particularly any. I thought I got hay fever, it sort of carried on with that. Third time around, it sort of knocked back my sense of smell again. I say I'm still sort of in recovery from that, though. Some smells are fine. I don't seem to have got the problem where smells are difficult, but I think I mentioned before how a lot of household detergents and things now have got massive perfume content. You know, it's difficult. You sort of catch it on the breeze, and you realise it's somebody walking past who's just used a particular brand of detergent or whatever, and it seems to trail around with them. So that's got a massive sort of dose of smell, which I can sort of pick up, and it's quite annoying in a lot of respects. So I kicked out our old washing powder and process and gone for something that doesn't really have much perfume.
Much chemicals in it. This is it. Yeah, going back to how we used to do it, natural cleaning products, if you like.
Yeah. It's quite a thing. But again, you know, sense of smell is one of those. It's quite difficult and quite funny for a lot of people. If you don't pick up the inappropriate smells.
Well, yeah. But anyway, this story's meant you could choose what is an absolute cracking piece of music. So tell us what you've gone for, Paul.
Oh, I think it smells like Team Spray.
Brilliant. By Nirvana. Great stuff, Paul. We'll speak
to you
Monday. Glory Days Rock Show, 1 till 3. Bye-bye, Paul. Bye.
Cheers. Bye. Bye.
What can I say? That is, honestly, my second favourite song of all time. That was Nirvana, Smells Like Teen Spirit, because, of course, our PG was talking about, amongst other things, a sense of smell. My favourite song of all time, in case anybody's interested, is Our Friends Electric by Tubeway Army. Amazing! I'm in heaven. Anyway, but you are listening to the Live Science Radio Show here on Sheffield Live, 93.2 FM on digital, if you're in South Yorkshire, sheffieldlive.org. Talking about science in all its different forms, every Saturday morning, 11 until 12. We should have Phil Muffet on the line.
I wish I was a spaceman, the fastest guy alive. I'd fly you round the universe in Fireball XL5. Way out in space together, conquers of the sky. My heart would be a fireball.
Good morning, Phil.
Good morning, South Yorkshire.
Good morning, eh?
And the world.
Bank holiday Saturday as well.
Yes, it is. And let's hope we have a nice weekend.
Well, the weather's looking good, but I fear there's going to be rain.
Tonight or tomorrow,
Phil.
Oh, don't say that.
Don't want that.
Oh, yes.
Now then, off air, I expected you to be at Manvers Waterfront Boat Club. And you said no. And I went, why aren't you there? But where are you off to this afternoon? Can you reveal all?
Stockton, near Newcastle. My wife is coaching in a race, the British National Dragon Boat Organisation have got a race. It's the first one of the year, and we're in it.
Wow!
And my son's helming, and I'm a paddler.
And you're what? A paddler?
Paddler.
Are you actually any good, Phil, at paddling? Oh yeah,
says I'm crap.
But they're letting you in. You're letting you on the boat though, even though. You... Anyway, will there be any cream crackers on this boat?
Because
didn't your son win a competition for eating the most cream crackers in 5 minutes?
Yes, at the weekend.
Do you know what family you've got, eh? What a family.
We had a member's trip to Oldswater last week and won the party games that Sunday.
Is that late? You mean Lake District?
Yeah.
We went
to Holy Bridge. We went to Waterside.
Lovely.
The campsite. And it was really dark and clear and I could see some. I was doing photography with me camera, picking out constellations and all kinds of stuff. It were really dark.
Oh, was it? So it's good, really nice good for viewing the night sky. Yeah.
Well, yeah, we did some water swimming, open water swimming, a bit of boating, paddle boarding, and generally messing about. And one of the party games was, how many cream crackers can you eat in 5 minutes? Well, apparently, I can only eat five. There's all kinds of tactics how to eat cream crackers, including stuffing several at once in your mouth.
Sounds dangerous to me, Phil, to be honest.
It's like eating polyfiller once you get you in your mouth. And, I don't think my son went to the toilet for a week.
I bet he's really pleased you said that on air, Phil. Yeah. Is he called William?
He's called William.
Do you know what a daddy's got, eh? Well, you're going off on your adventures. I can't believe it. So you're not a Manvers. But for people who don't know, what you get up to as well is obviously you're into astronomy and you're a member of the Maxwell Swinton Astronomical Society. Going from strength to strength, I have to say. You're all over social media all the time, aren't you?
We try. It is hard. We are pushing it out there. And I wish we could get some more new younger members into the club. I mean, we've got about 40, 50 members, but we have not got enough younger people. If any of those young people out there are interested in astronomy, don't just do it online. Join a club like ours, especially if you're in South Yorkshire. Because you need people. As you know, our chairman's recently died. And when I think back, to where I was when I was 18, I did astronomy on my own and then I joined a club and it completely... Changed everything for me, and I wouldn't be where I am today if it had to be for people like Les in a club that helped everybody out and get where we are today.
Yeah, and it's a social thing, isn't it? You know, doing your hobby on your own is a bit... It's all right, but it's not quite the same, is it?
Yeah, astronomers have got a bit of a reputation for being loners, and to be honest, it's nice.
Paul's laughing now. That's cruel.
it is nice to do astronomy on your own, and you're in your own zone and you're in your own space. I think it's a bit like fishing. You're concentrating on what you're doing, and you've got to be in the zone to do it. However, being in a club and being with other people and sharing an experience, or even like a meteor star party, or and you see a meteor that's really bright streaks, everybody gasps and says, "Whoa, look at that! Anybody see that?" And doing photography and finding objects and look, can you see the faint detail in the spiral arms? And oh, I didn't notice that. How do you see these cloud belts in Jupiter? And oh, there's all that kind of stuff. And as an individual, you can miss so much, but as a club and as a group, you can like share the experience and be like-minded people. And the other thing is, you're with other people that come from different backgrounds, and you've got people that have got, I don't know, different experiences, done different things, and it's all like a journey, and I'm still on my journey.
You are. It's been a long journey, Phil, hasn't it? Particularly the one with your telescope.
Yes, I am improving on my stacking, my live stacking images. And my longest one now, I've done a 30-minute exposure of some galaxies. While we're talking about photography and galaxies, it is currently what's known as the galaxy season. Because at the moment, I don't know if people are going out there looking at the sky, but really you don't be going out till really 10 o'clock onwards because the sky's not dark enough. And come the summertime, it'll be even worse.
It'll be even later, won't it? Yeah.
We don't get proper darkness in the middle of the summer around the solstice. But we've got constellations like Virgo, Leo, Coma Berenices, Canes Lunatici, Ursa Major, Boots. They've all got loads of galaxies in these constellations. Now, when we think about it, there's galaxies all over the sky. However, the galaxy covers a lot of the sky, so you can't see through the galaxy to the galaxies at the other side. However, because these constellations are above the plane of the galaxy, we're kind of looking out of the shortest distance of the galaxy, so we can see galaxies above and below us. Ursa Major, in fact, that's where the Hubble Space Telescope did its real deep sky long exposure. It picks apart part of the sky where there was the fewest amount of stars and galaxies, and picked up all these really, really faint galaxies millions of light years away.
Wow.
So, the other thing is, these galaxies are all directly overhead. Now, the higher things are in the sky, to your zenith, the clearer the sky is. So if I'm looking down over Rotherham, I get light pollution, atmospheric pollution and refraction of the atmosphere. When I'm looking straight up, I'm looking through the least amount of atmosphere, so the light is steadier. So the galaxies are overhead, and it's a really good opportunity to take some images of galaxies, which I've been doing this past 2 weeks, thanks to the clear weather window we've been having, and I hope it continues into next week.
So why is it galaxy season? What makes
it's because this time of year the sky's moving round, so like Orion is in the part of the spiral galaxy arm, and so it's constellations like Cassiopeia and Perseus. Now, because they've moved round into the evening sky, with the spiral arms have moved round, so the Earth's looking in a different direction. So the Earth's kind of looking up out of the spiral arm. So we're looking above the galaxy, not through the galaxy, if you see what I'm trying to say. So it gives us a clearer visual aspect of the cosmos rather than just looking through our galaxy. Does that make sense?
I think it does. That's pretty heavy stuff, Phil, actually.
Yeah, yeah.
So to get your head round how we're moving.
Yeah, so imagine you have a fried egg for your breakfast, and the centre yellow bit is the middle of the galaxy. Now, we're in the white bit around the edge of it, roughly halfway between the centre of the egg and the edge of the egg in the white bit, and we're somewhere like in the middle of that. Now, if you look towards the centre of the egg, you're not going to see what's at the other side of the egg on the frying pan, because there's all the stars and the galaxy in the
yeah.
way. However, if I'm in the white bit of the egg looking up out of the pan, I'm seeing straight out, and there's nothing in the way in the galaxy. There's less stars in your way, so you get a clearer view of the galaxy above and below the plane of the galaxy. Does that make sense?
Is that, yes, it does. Is that to do with the tilt of the Earth then?
Well, yeah, it is tilt. Yeah, we are tilted. And remember, we're going around the sun and we get seasonal changes. So the seasons have moved round, and so we're looking through a different part of the sky in the galaxy.
Wow.
Okay.
Ooh.
So then when it gets round to autumn, we'll start looking through the other side of the spiral arm, and then later on we'll look through another part of the galaxy. But this part of the galaxy that we're looking out of, we can see a lot of external galaxies, and there's thousands of them. And some are really big and some are really small, but they're really, really interesting. It's where a lot of the Messier objects are in the sky that... Charles Messier discovered in France. They thought they were comets at first. And of course, a Messier album is a catalogue of objects not to look at that we really enjoy looking at. So, with my ZWO camera and whatnot, I'm getting some really, really good images of some of these galaxies. Some of them I've never seen before.
Wow.
The thing is, with the ZWO camera and my setup, I've got an in-house. A star chart in my phone, so what I can do is select a galaxy to look at and press go, and my telescope will find it. So that street light that's really, really annoying me in my garden now isn't a problem, because my telescope does what's called plate solving. So it knows where it's looking. When I tell it to move, it knows how far to move. It takes an image of the sky, compares it against its memory bank, adjusts it, lines all the stars up, and then I can do a long exposure for something like 30 minutes.
Wow.
And the object appears in my camera. Well, it appears on my phone. So it's absolutely marvellous.
So you couldn't have done this without the setup and the telescope and everything you've got now?
Well, when I look back, I could find objects, but you have to be experienced. So if I wanted to find a faint galaxy in Coma Berenices, I'd first have to find Arcturus, which I can see with my naked eye. Then I'd look for the next faintest star, which is like New Bootes, and then I could jump across to Coma Berenices, look for the next faintest star, and then I'd star hop through my finder scope until I actually find the object I'm looking for fainter and fainter stars. The problem is, it could take you half an hour to find what you're looking for. Now I can find what I'm looking for in like 60 seconds, 2 minutes, and then I can start doing photography, and it just appears in my phone, and it's saved in my memory bank. So it's basically just made the experience, how can I put it, a lot easier.
And more rewarding, I guess.
Yes.
For the time you're out there, because weather can change and cloud can come and everything. So, you know, you put an image up, I think, on social media, and where you'd stacked images.
Yes. I think that was M51, which is in Ursa Major. It's on the handle of the pan near the star Alcade. Now, what I would do is I'd find Alcade with my naked eye, point my telescope in that direction, find it in my eyepiece, on my finder scope, and then I know how big the field of view is that I'm looking at. So then I'd start to move in the right direction, and I would star hop from fainter and fainter and fainter stars. Now that might take me, after some experience, you do get quicker, but to find it for the first time was really, I don't know, it might take 20 minutes, but I could have got it down to like a few minutes and I could find it, because you recognise the star fields. So then you put your camera on that you can't see what you're taking a photograph of, hope it's in the right place, and then do a shot. Now, the other thing is, I could only do 8-second exposures of the Whirlpool galaxy last year. With the ZWO camera on me as the air, I'm actually doing 30-second exposures and then stacking them for half an hour. So I've got a half an hour exposure combined.
Wow.
And I've got a much, much better image, and you can actually see detail, fainter stars, and it actually looks like something you can see in a really, really big telescope.
Wow.
So, yeah, it's an absolute game changer.
Is it?
So, and I've still got stuff to learn. I mean, I'm just like at the beginning.
Thing is, the more you learn, the more you realise you don't know, and then...
Yeah,
and the more you realise you need a bigger telescope, and it's never ending.
Well, you would say that, and I would have said that at one time, but when you look at people that are doing this photography, they're all using smaller telescopes.
Oh,
72 millimeter telescope. A lot are using 100 millimeter telescopes, or even a 50 millimeter telescopes, because of the lightness. What's changed? It's the power of the CCD chip and how small the sensors are in the chip that's improved stuff, and the computing power of your devices, including your phone.
Yeah.
And I've also found there's an editing suite in the Asia Air program. And what I can do is, once I've took my picture, I can like alter the background, make it darker, bring out the clouds more. So there's a function inside the device that helps you improve your image that you've taken. The thing is, you need the raw data to start with. So now I'm looking at how long do I need to spend taking a photograph? 10 minutes, 15,
oh,
half an hour or an hour. Now, some people, one of our friends, John Leach, I think he's done a 57-hour exposure on M51, and you've got lots and lots of colours. But he's built it up over weeks and weeks and weeks, because you can save different exposures and multiply them together. So he's got like a 50-odd hour
exposure. Wow.
And you can see quite a lot of detail. So you don't particularly need a big telescope. Now, the thing is, what happens is, when you've got a bigger aperture telescope, you get better resolution. So if two stars are close together, or you've got clouds of dust, the resolution or the clarity improves, but you're not really seeing any fainter objects because there's that tail off effect. It's same with photography. The longer you take an exposure, you have to double the amount of time taking your exposure to get a perceivable improvement. And the same goes for telescopes. As you get bigger and bigger and bigger, you have to get a lot bigger to make a big difference.
So, you know, you say because the technology is better, people are using lighter telescopes.
Yeah, C-stars, 50 C-stars.
You mentioned the power of the CCD chip. What's that?
Yeah, that's the sensor that takes your photo. So, yeah, you know your iPhone has got a camera inside of it. There'll be a tiny chip in there that's a CCD charge-coupled device. Now they've got CMOS. Which is using the ZWOs and other astronomy cameras. It's just a different type of chip that collects light in a slightly different way, and it's more efficient and it's more suitable for astronomy. And they've not got the filters in that they're using like your iPhones, so there's no bias colours. So you've got more of a raw colour that you can actually do more things with, because the cleaner the image, the purer the data, the more you can do with it, if you see where I'm coming
from. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Amazing.
So, yeah. So for the amateur astronomer, to be honest, I mean, if you want to discover a supernova, you really don't need a very big camera anymore, a telescope or camera. It's the camera that's in the back of the telescope that's important. Or if you want to find a comet, discovering comets, you can do it from home. You don't need an observatory on a big mountain in Tenerife, although there are advantages to doing that as well.
Yeah, but obviously your club has got an observatory.
On a hill.
On a hill. Above Rotherham. Well, Hoover, near Hoover Stand, isn't it?
Yes, yes.
But there's still great benefits in having an observatory, I would say.
Yeah, there is. Well, it's darker for a start. We haven't got the pollution that we've got down here. The other thing is, you are above a lot of the pollution because believe me, when you look over Rotherham and Sheffield, and you might have noticed it on some of these clear nights, the horizon is more orange. It's got more ochre colour in it, and that is pollution. Now, if you remember back in COVID, when the sun went down, the sky was clear.
Yeah.
Now, when the sun goes down, there's an ochre colour in the horizon. I know we noticed that actually last week at Mambers when we were finishing his dragon boating session on a Monday night, at like 7:30, 8 o'clock, the sun was going down. you could see those colours in the atmosphere, and those colours are pollution.
So, do you know what sort of pollution that is? Because Ochre says to me iron, but I guess it's sulphur.
Yeah. Oh, I would imagine so.
Or nitrogen.
Carbon monoxide, all those things. And dust, of course, there's just plain old dust as well. So when we weren't driving around in cars and flying aircraft, just think of all and people were stopping in, we weren't commuting as
we much. Weren't driving, and yeah, but I remember that because it was, the skies were a different colour, weren't they?
It was whiter. A lot of people say, you know, the sun's yellow. It's not. It's white. We have white light, and the sky was whiter because it wasn't being refracted by particles in the atmosphere.
It just shows, doesn't it, what happens when things change. But you as astronomers are going to notice that a lot more.
Yes, yeah. So the other thing is, if it rains in an evening and the sky's clearer afterwards, one of the things is the water cools it. Well, it's a different temperature. If you've got a sunny, hot day and then you have a shower in the evening, it cools the air down and you also reduce and remove the pollutants in the atmosphere because it brings them down with the rain, so you get a clearer, steadier night. So we've actually noticed that.
Oh, it's amazing, isn't it, what you can find out just by looking at the sky?
It is. Oh yes.
So what else is there to look at? Is there any meteor showers?
Eta Aquarids on the 6th of May, which is my birthday. So there's a waning gibbous moon on that night, so it'll be up after midnight. So you have got a chance of seeing some meteors that night.
So they're the Aquarids then? So is that linked to be Aquarius then?
Well, that's where the centre of the radiant comes from.
I noticed how you slipped in. It is your birthday on Wednesday. I'm not going to say how old you are, though. Not on air, Phil, no. I just can't believe where that time has gone, because I think you got that telescope for a significant birthday.
Yeah, look how far I've come in 2 years.
Look how far you've come in 2 years. I can't believe it's 2 years. Bloody hell. You'll be retiring soon. You'll be retiring soon, Phil.
I will be.
Get them to take... before you retire from Rotherham Council, make sure they come and sort that streetlight out. You know, because it does annoy you, doesn't it?
It does. It's less of a problem now, but yes, you're right. Well, the other thing is, so at Manvers, the swimmers have started doing moon swims. So on every full moon, they're doing a swim in the evening.
Oh, wow. Okay.
So they did one the other day. I think the water temperature was something like 16 degrees the other day when they did
that. Isn't that good?
It's jumped up. I think that the week of sunshine has definitely boosted the temperature of the lake up.
Wow.
But on the 31st of May, we have got, guess what, another full moon. So it is a blue moon on the 31st of May.
Wow.
So there's not very often we get blue moons. I think we had one last year. We've got another one this year, which is on the 31st of May.
So that's when there's two full moons within the same month.
That's right, yeah. I think they called this full moon the flower moon, I think it was. I think that's what they called it.
Have you never got Manvers, if they're doing moonlight swims, have you never got Manvers then, people from there interested in astronomy, just by sheer fact that you're out there anyway?
I've done a couple of talks at Manvers on photography and astronomy, yes. I did one last year, I did one year, was it last year or this year? I think I did it just after Christmas, and I did one the year before. But yeah, there's a couple of people. So Arkin has got, she lives in Bolton, she's got a C-star 50, and she's been doing some lovely photos of galaxies. So there are a few people. Sean Johnson, one of the runners, he's got a C-star as well. We've been swapping notes on how to take photographs and how to improve your stuff. So there's lots of people with C-stars. It's kind of opened up a window to the universe. It's a small portable device you can set up, connect to your phone, and it's just like a small telescope. It's like a robotic telescope, really.
Oh, so is that something you recommend for somebody who's just moving on from binoculars?
Yeah, the only thing is about £500.
Gosh.
But when you look at them, the detail, because the optics and the cameras are so good in them, you can get really fine detail, and the optics are really, really good, and it finds things just like my Azier Plus that I've got. I went, rather than get a small portable telescope, I've got a one that I can put together, and I can alter things and change things and add to things. So I've got a more flexible system, but it's a lot bigger and a lot heavier. I have to take my gear to bit to move it onto the patio.
I can feel a birthday wish coming on here, Phil. A £500 Sea Star telescope that you could take
On holiday.
In fact, yeah. We're going to let you go now, Phil, because you've got a busy afternoon ahead of you, and we wish you all the best for the British National Dragon Boat Race.
Yes. Thank you very much.
Bloody hell. And happy birthday for Wednesday. Happy birthday for Wednesday, Phil.
Happy birthday.
Thanks for joining us. Bye-bye, Phil. Bye. Bye.